For this episode of the PeopleStack podcast, Rob Allen, my husband and co-CEO at the PeopleStack, interviewed Dan Pickett. Dan is president and founder of Launch Academy and Launchware. So Launch Academy is a coding boot camp that is in the Boston area. And in Rob's former life, when he worked for a software company in Boston, he hired many of the Launch Academy graduates. So that's how Dan and Rob know one another. And so Dan talks about Launch Academy. He talks about the apprenticeship model that they use to train coders. So what's interesting about Launch Academy is that they train prior professionals. So they take folks who had a prior professional career in something other than software engineering, and they train them to be coders. And they follow a model where they really help them to dive deep, not just in terms of learning how to code, but also in learning how to be a part of the engineering and tech culture. I was actually invited. I did a training for them one time on interviewing to prepare them as the Launch Academy graduates were preparing for interviewing for new roles. So they really have a wonderfully warm atmosphere there. And at Launch Academy, and Dan and Rob talk about culture. They talk about how weaving a fabric of culture is so important. Yes, for in this Launch Academy model, in this apprenticeship model of training future coders, in making sure that they're prepared for their future jobs, but it's also important no matter what you're doing, no matter what job you have, you need to create a safe and inviting culture for everyone. So they talk about that. They dive deep into lots of other topics, including computer science education, and how this model should be used even more in computer science education as well. Look, it's not just about the facts and the figures. It's about so much more than that. So if you are at all involved in tech, and even if you're not, you're going to find this conversation very, very enlightening, very, very informative, and it's going to be particularly eye-opening if you lead tech teams. So enjoy.
Welcome to the PeopleStack podcast, where I share insights on how to upgrade your career as a technical leader. I'm Jen Funk. I am a career coach and co-CEO of the PeopleStack, along with my husband, Rob Allen. If you'd like to find out more about what we do here at the PeopleStack, please check out our free training at training.thepeoplestack.com. You're going to learn the four strategic and mindset shifts that our clients have used to command 300, 400, 500K plus salaries as tech leaders while living lives of abundance, freedom, and joy. And now, without further ado, please enjoy today's episode.
With me today is Dan Pickett, president and founder of Launch Academy and the recently launched Launchware. And Dan and I have a fun history going back where he created New Engineers. And then as part of my company that I was working for before, I hired them. Dan, I think I hired or helped hire around 30 something of your graduates.
That's amazing. Yeah, you've been a great partner and a great supporter of what we've been doing over the years. And I'm really grateful.
Awesome. They were some of my favorite people to hire and work with. And I've hired people, you know, off the street, the old fashioned way. You post a job ad, you go through a series of different motions, and then you bring the people in. But the way Launch Academy had, well, I need to back up. One of the distinctions, at least in my mind, and you can comment on whether or not you see this as being a big point, is everybody that went through Launch had a prior life and a prior profession. And so there was a realism and a focus that came with that. Some of the people that we've hired from launch and their prior history, they had studied law, they had studied medicine. One ran a commercial bakery. She now works at Facebook. A couple of people had just like these really intricate, really intense former careers. And they recognized that coding was something that was going to be more important to them, and launch helped them get into a role. And so thank you for that, because they were awesome people to work with. I'm still in touch with many of them, and would love to continue to do that. So when you went about founding Launch Academy, first and foremost, what itch was that scratching? Where did that dream come from?
Yeah, so it actually originated from our consultancy. We had decided a few years before we launched our first cohort with Launch Academy that we were going to become a training company. And the reason we felt strongly about that was we have demonstrated through very early apprenticeships. This is, I want to say, 2010, 2011. That we could teach somebody that's hungry and pliable, moldable talent, and get them to a place where they could meaningfully add value for our clients. And there was something to this. And for me, just thinking about my own dreams and where I wanted to take my career, like this idea of being able to mold and shape an engineer and help them grow into what they want to be, but also what we expected professionally from our consultants, it was like incredibly empowering. So it's like, I want more of that dopamine. I need to do this in another way. And so at the time, a colleague of mine, Jeff Kazmir, was doing Jumpstart Labs, I think was the name of the firm. And he had partnered with Living Social. There's a name, a blast from the past. To run this cohort and say, hey, we're going to train these really entry-level folks. We're going to see how it goes. And if you like what they can do, you can hire them on Living Social. Jeff was pretty successful, if memory serves, at that effort. There's something to this. And then I ended up partnering with another entrepreneur here in the Boston area to found Launch Academy. And that's where sort of Launch Academy was born. But for me, it was, at the time, there was significant demand for Ruby on Rails developers. And I would hire, say, subcontractors or senior engineers. And there were so many bad habits that we had to break. And there was so much resistance to breaking those bad habits. It's like, there has to be a better way. Why don't we bring somebody on that is just so much more receptive to the Rails way? At the time, it was the Rails way, and the Rails way was very consistent with the way we build software today. You know, how do we build an engineer rather than buy an engineer? And that's where sort of the apprenticeship model was born for us.
Wonderful, wonderful. And I've loved that, because at the places that I've worked, I've taken more of an apprenticeship approach with everybody that I've worked with, even the people I was supposedly reporting to, which is why I eventually replaced them, I think. And I find that to be very effective, and to have an amazingly wonderful feedback loop that allows people to grow quickly. So do you want to talk a bit about what it looks like from inside of a launcher's kind of view, and how much of that feeds into your success?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think it comes down to simulating the work environment in a low stakes, welcoming and encouraging learning opportunity, right? So I think there is a problem in today's sort of entry level software engineering world, where we're spinning people out way too quickly, right? And I can explain a little bit more about what that means. So, and I'm guilty of this in the consultancy as well. Of you have such high expectations of entry level professionals that you demand so much more than what they are ready to provide, right? So in the educational world, we talk a lot about the zone of proximal development. And for podcast listeners, you can imagine two concentric circles, right? And in the middle is what the engineer knows. And then there's a middle part, and then outside of that union between the two circles, it's stuff that's totally out of bounds for the learner, right, at that moment. And our job as educators, our jobs as managers, is to stretch that zone of proximal development, that middle part, the donut, right, as much as possible, and making sure that we're assigning tasks that are within that zone of proximal development, right? So I think for junior engineers, if you're a computer science grad or boot camp grad, or maybe you've learned on your own, you really get thrown into the deep end. And we do not provide early engineers with opportunities to get their feet underneath them and to be successful at maybe doing a few rote things and building that confidence and building that ability. To say, okay, I can do this. And so from our vantage point, that's what Launch Academy is. Launch Academy is designed to build that confidence and to give folks the lattice work of getting to kind of meaningful software engineering work without all the stress and anxieties of being obligated to perform on the job.
Wonderful. And so you talked a little bit about the creation of Launch. When you dream about what is going to be possible, both for you and your team, as well as the people who are going through your boot camp, what are the high hopes that you can remember already being checked off?
Well, the first thing that we wanted to do was to have this symbiotic relationship between a consultancy and a code school. So dating all the way back to sort of first gen of Launchware, we knew we wanted to be a training company. We knew we wanted to help cultivate engineers. How can we do that and still maintain sort of this professional consultant persona, right? So from a checkbox perspective, we've definitely checked off, okay, we have this Launchware consulting entity and this Launch Academy educational entity. And our clients and our students can see the benefits, the many, many benefits of having these two institutions kind of sitting side by side. For us, that allows our faculty to go and get that real-world experience and refresh their own sort of professional skill sets and to get a break from teaching, right? Teaching can be a rather exhausting endeavor, right? It's a very empathic and emotional pursuit, right? Sometimes it's nice to just crack open an editor and start coding away. So we get that. We want to be understanding of that. But for me, the future and where we're headed is, okay, how can we extend that low stakes learning environment and some of the coursework that we're doing into a consulting apprenticeship, where we know as educators and also as practicing consultants, okay, these are the road tasks. These are in that zone of proximal development sweet spot for the junior engineer and where they are right now. We can easily delegate that at significant cost savings for the client, allow them to get that confidence and put their feet under them, and then effectively level them up that way. So that's the dream and the vision for cultivating talent from the school into the consultancy and then eventually out to our client companies.
Wonderful. I love that you call the people who do the teaching faculty and not just senior engineers or staff engineers or tech leads, because for a lot of junior folks, they get shoved onto a team somewhere. And there's somebody who is being ridden like a chariot horse to deliver something. And by the way, while you're delivering that thing, teach this person how to be a functional engineer. Where did the faculty model come from?
Well, so actually, we have a name. I'm a big fan of kind of branding and being intentional about engineering your customer experience, right? So we actually have a name for our instructors, experience engineer, right? They're engineering the learning experience on behalf of the students. In public and otherwise, we refer to them as faculty, but the reason for that is we put the education first, right? Yes, we teach technology, and technology is at the center of what we're doing, but so much of computer science education, STEM education, is really about metacognition, which means learning how to learn, right? Learning how to problem solve, learning how to learn new things, right? Because what is an absolute certainty in technology is, TypeScript and JavaScript and Node.js we're learning today, right? Who knows what programming language and framework is going to be taught 3 years from now, right? When we first started, we were pretty much exclusively Ruby on Rails. We taught a little bit of HTML and CSS as well, and maybe a little JavaScript, but just even in our short life, relatively speaking, we've seen probably 4 to 6 major evolutions of our curriculum. And so what we need to teach our engineers is how to level up on technology incredibly quickly. And so faculty really puts that first and foremost, right? Sure, you have a software engineering background, but at its core, you're teaching a human something very human, which is how to solve problems and how to learn something at an accelerated rate.
Wonderful. And so when you contrast that with what I'm going to call it the traditional comp sci program, because when granted it was in the mid 90s that I was in college, my comp sci friends, my degrees in psychology, I took comp sci to raise my GPA because I was getting disillusioned with some of my courses and computers were a fun thing that I knew. Didn't realize it was going to be the rest of my life, but it's awesome that it is. But even then, most of the comp sci curriculum seemed to be algorithms, operating systems, applied calculus, and doing what your professor told you without understanding why.
Exactly.
Are you still seeing that in modern graduates of comp sci programs?
Absolutely. Unfortunately, I have not seen a major evolution in computer science education as a result of boot camps. There was a time and a hope that I had that boot camps would exponentially disrupt traditional education. So I was fortunate. I went to WPI. It had they had a lot more practical sort of elements in our education. It was very project based, a lot of kind of software engineering, object oriented design principles. So there were some great courses in that area, but I would say 80% of my computer science education was also focused on algorithms, operating systems, and technologies that I've hardly ever used in my profession, right? And I
Well, I
do
mean,
think,
you start
go
every day with a good filter sort, right?
ahead. Right. You have to know that these algorithms are so important.
Yeah.
But what I find so disconcerting about it, for me as a computer scientist, right? I was fortunate in that I had significant programming experience prior to coming into my computer science degree. So I understood the need for these things, right? But your average, 18, 19-year-old that doesn't have a tremendous amount of programming knowledge, and they're totally uninitiated to a for loop or a while loop, right? To be thrown immediately into like big O notation and calculating algorithmic complexity, they just don't have enough programming context under their belt to meaningfully understand what this concept is, right? So talk about being outside of that zone of proximal development, right? And so for us, our kind of feeling is we teach computer science backwards. In order to be an effective computer scientist and to understand algorithms and algorithmic complexity and design patterns, you have to do a lot of bad programming first, right? Like it just has to be part of it. And I don't think computer science programs either have the room or the time, the luxury of time to empower an engineer to write really bad code and struggle through that. And so, you know, we hear it all the time from our bootcamp grads, and I'm sure you've had this phenomenon too, is you pull up code that's 2, 3 years old, and it's kind of scratching your head, who the heck wrote this? And
Oh
then you
shit,
look
it was me.
at, yeah, you get blame it, and it's you, and you're like, oh man, that hurts.
You do the
That's
git bisect and you find out that you introduced this bug 3 years ago.
yeah, exactly. So from my vantage point, right, syntax, getting your code to solve problems is the Neolithic kind of programming step one, right? And then you build from there. And so my main qualm with traditional computer science education is it feels backwards. There's not enough initiation to programming and solving problems. And then we throw all this theoretical, mathy kind of science at students. And the unfortunate thing is it totally disenfranchises them. They're like, I just want to do cool stuff with a computer. Like, I don't care about this mathy stuff, right? So that's another unfortunate side effect.
Yeah, and Jen and I see that a lot too, even with people who are further on in seniority, because they, I don't know where it comes from. I can't speak to how it got there, but for a lot of senior engineers and higher architects, etc., they keep trying to get back to what their computer science education was about, and they lose sight of the fact that the only reason people pay us to write code is to solve real human problems. And if you're not solving real human problems, what the F are you really doing? It doesn't matter how much you code golf this particular algorithm or this particular method if it doesn't solve a real human problem.
That's what I struggle with so much with senior engineering interviews now is, right, like I learned how to traverse a binary tree 12 years ago, at this point, I think 20, 22 years ago. Why the hell are you asking an architect how to traverse a binary tree? Like, give me a real world problem, like a significant infrastructure problem that you're facing. Let's talk about it. Let me understand the trade-offs. You can qualify the way in which I'm exploring and trying to get to the root of what this issue is. That's what I'm going to be doing on the job. Like, I'm not going to be re-implementing bubble sort for you. It's like, come on, people. Like, I know we're a young industry, but I think we can advance and evolve a little bit from the bubble sort and the traversing binary tree interview questions.
Yeah, about let's see, it's 2024 now, so this would be yeah, a good 14, 15 years ago, I had an interview with Amazon, and one of the questions was if you had a system with 256 megabytes of RAM and you needed it to handle a 1 gigabyte file, what would you do? I said I would go on Amazon.com and buy more effing RAM.
Sure.
That wasn't the answer they needed because they were working on a particular piece of hardware at the time that was going to be cost limited to have a certain amount of onboard RAM. Now, had they told me that, we could have had a wonderful discussion about streaming, but they didn't tell me that. They just held tight to the no, well, how would you solve this algorithmically? Why would I spend time on an algorithm when a gig of RAM is 20 bucks?
Well, that's the other thing too, right? Is I think as computer scientists, the curriculum that's out there today is still very much constrained by hardware restrictions, right? And now we have such abundance of hardware availability and compute power, that stuff isn't as important. Now, that's not to say, I think if you look at a lot of boot campers code, a lot of entry-level code, there are frequently memory issues, right? In terms of loading way too much data into memory, doing in-memory computations where you should be relying on SQL, right? There's that all over the place, and that is a problem. But I mean, to be thinking about, okay, I have 16 gigs of data for a database, and I need to shrink it down to compress it down to 8. How would you do that? I would just make a bigger RDS instance on Amazon. It's just like there's such an abundance now of hardware. Like, just throw hardware at it. Sure, like as your expenses, massively uptick, then you look at optimization opportunity. But in terms of stemming the bleeding, just add more compute power.
My son, who's going to be 15 in a couple weeks, which, okay, is a thing. He's learning Python, and he's learning Python because he loves video games, but mostly he doesn't want to create a new video game. He wants to change existing games.
Nice.
And so he had to learn somewhere. And so every once in a while, I'll throw an article at him, like the one for Fallout, where in order to get around the limitations of the game engine, they for a tram, they gave the character a hat shaped like a subway car, and then increased its movement speed while it was wearing this particular hat. And so there's interesting solutions like that are going to come up from real world challenges when you do come up against real world problems. And that's the fun, juicy bits of turning into a senior engineer in my head. As a junior engineer, I don't expect you to know that. I expect you to do something that works. And if it doesn't work good enough, then we're going to coach you to the good enough and then coach you to the better. Until eventually, as a software engineer, no senior, no junior, you know there must be a better way for this. Hey, help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. Let's work this out.
Yeah, you develop that conscience. Exactly.
Exactly. Yes. Jen and I are working again at the opposite end of that, whereas a senior or a staff principal or architect, you've been banging your head on the same stuff for so long, and you can't understand why you're not moving forward and why your work's not speaking for itself anymore. It's because your work never spoke for itself. You just learned how to solve problems more effectively, and you stopped doing that.
100%. And that's, I think the next thing for a lot of engineers, right, is we've been talking a lot about technology and syntax and algorithms, but what we would try really hard to convey, both in the consultancy and in the school, software is an exercise in communication, right? So it's not just about syntax. It's about making sure you understand the problem that you're trying to solve. It's making sure that you're bringing team members along with you to arrive at a good solution. Making sure you've got management buy-in, at the top, right? The reality is it's a business, it's a business, it's a business. And you have to not only be like a native software engineer, like and know how to talk the talk there. But if you really want to accelerate your career as a technology executive or even principal engineer, you have to learn the language of your business and understand how to communicate business value.
Absolutely. And when you say buy-in and it's a business, buy-in with management and leadership and with business, I think a lot of engineers hear those as dirty words, as in that's polluting the purity of the execution. When in fact, the only reason your execution exists and is valuable in any way, shape, or form is because there's a business need.
You can't deposit lines of code into your bank account.
Sell
you
that to
need
Bitcoin.
to generate you need to generate business value, right? And I do, I think for like really strong technologists, they just see the syntax and the code and the elegance of their solution. And it's really, and especially in larger companies, to feel very far removed from the problems that you're actually trying to solve.
Indeed. And so when you're trying to educate, so, and I think this is where the launchers having had prior careers, that's very beneficial. I know I have very powerful, wonderful memories of hearing in the, so for listeners, the end of a launcher's curriculum, and you can correct me if this is still the case, Dan, is that they have to do a presentation. And there's a career day where they give their presentation to a bunch of companies looking to hire. And at a lot of those career days, something that always strikes me is I was doing XYZ career. I was a week from get passing the bar. I had passed the bar, but I had been sitting in a back room doing Excel sheets for the partners. I was in a medical program and I realized that the syntax that I was writing for SPSS or whatever was more fun. I were doing this other profession that I thought my life was going to be and realized that solving problems faster through code was going to be a more beneficial experience. And I think a lot of those launchers came into the company I was working for that we hired them for. They came in looking to solve problems, not just write beautiful code. They wanted to write beautiful code in order to solve the problems because they understood there was value there. But they came in already having the real world life experience, lived experience of there's a better way to do this, and code probably has it.
100%. They came in with an itch they wanted to scratch.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The other thing I think that comes to play here as well is a computer scientist, at least in my own experience, somebody that's going to school for computer science has a tremendous amount of intrinsic motivation, meaning motivation coming from within themselves to produce beautiful code. Right, to produce elegant solutions. And you have a computer science degree program that lauds and claps and praises on elegant solutions and things that are algorithmically efficient and all that, right? So it's a change in the persona of the motivation coming into an educational experience, but then you also have a distinct difference in what we're cultivating in a computer science education program and a boot camp program, right? The boot camp program is encouraging a student to add business value, to contribute something of meaning, to get something working, get something in the editor, right? We're not grading you and marking you down because you had exponential complexity. I probably leave a code comment and say, "Don't do that," right? If it's not necessary, right? But the emphasis is on solving problems with software, right? So it's those two things combined that I think create quite a bit of contrast in your sort of traditional computer science candidate and a boot camp grad candidate. A, the motivations going into the educational experience are different, and then B, what's kind of lauded and celebrated in either academic institution is quite different.
Wonderful. Now, the first cohorts of Launch Academy were round, was the first cohort 2014 or 2015, somewhere in that neck of the woods of actual Launch Academy?
2013, so May 1st,
2013.
2013, yeah.
So all of those folks are now over a decade into their careers. Have you kept tabs on them?
Yeah, absolutely. And what's thrilling is they've definitely ascended into senior engineering positions. Some folks have become engineering managers, some folks have become entrepreneurs. And that's been, of the last 10 years, probably the biggest privilege of my own sort of vocation, is that we launched them. We helped them kind of hack them into tech and look at them now. Look how successful they've been. And it's been my greatest joy, honestly, the last couple of years watching people grow into their potential and grow into what we knew they could be.
It is a thing of beauty. Having promoted some of those very same people, I'm right there with you. I think that is something that you and I have shared going back, is that a distinct love for not growing code bases so much as growing the coders that write them and bringing them along the way for the ride. Where do you see those entrepreneurs and senior engineers and engineering managers that have gone through the boot camp with that prior lived life experience and their boot camp experience and their in-work experience now? Where do you see them going in the next decade?
Well, there's lots of talk of AI, and myself included. I have a significant interest in learning things like vector databases. I'm looking at the open source models, Mistral, Llama, a little bit of LangChain in there too. So there seems to be a lot of interest in that direction. I think that for me, what I've seen with alumni is maybe a trifurcation, right? Where some folks go the management track, right? And they want to ascend to, director, VP level engineering kind of roles. And then you have, I want to be a principal engineer, I want to be like really good with my craft and I want to know my stuff. And then what's interesting, and I think this is a function of everyone's prior lives, we also have this slant of flirting into product and moving into product management. I would say I see those sort of three different directions for our grads.
I'm giggling a little bit about the forays into product because most engineers that deal with a product organization within their company eventually decide that they're going to be better at managing the product than the people in that particular group of the org and want to go do that job only to find out that it gets paid half as much as the software engineers do.
That's very, very true. But I think what you also see is quite a bit of burnout, right? Of software engineering. Like if I have to create another CRUD app, I'm done. I just can't do it, right? Product, I think, is there's a seductiveness to it, right? Of, oh, I'm solving problems at a higher level of abstraction. I'm solving, business strategic problems rather than building a CRUD app, so I think a lot of folks see it as a reprieve. They're running away from some of the pains of engineering more than they are running toward a bountiful job opportunity, I think, in a lot of circumstances.
I think that's definitely true. And I also think it's a search for more certainty that the work that they're doing has a particular value and a particular end value. Because there's a lot of code that's written that never sees the light of day. There's a lot of features that are created that never see the light of day. I had a team of extremely talented designers and coders working with me two jobs back. And they created a new UI control for a women's clothing company to use. And they pitched it to the clothing company. And the clothing company representative said, "We love it. This is beautiful. It makes so much sense. It would be so great. But our users are too conservative. We can never use this. Go back to the dropdowns and the color pickers."
Died on the vine.
Died on the vine. I bought them a very, very, very nice bottle of tequila and said, "I'm sorry, here."
How kind of you to drown their sorrows.
I mean, well, they did the work at my insistence, and so I owed them for it, basically. I convinced them that this was a worthwhile use of 2 weeks of their time, and it ended up not being. They took it all the way from ideation to completion with two of my engineers. They had a functioning working control that was beautiful, intuitive, and made the product look good. And then nothing. So I think a lot of people go into products so that they can have that additional bit of control.
Right, 100%, right? The bridge to nowhere, right? I think a lot in product, in sort of the, I don't know, I'm a 1980s like old school gamer, so I think of like the lemmings kind of falling off the bridge, like, oh man, this feature is going nowhere, right? And I think that there is, as especially as you grow in seniority, this desire for more say in the direction of the product, and I think that that is why a lot of folks move towards product management, because they want to be in those conversations and they want to, inform the rest of the executive group of, okay, these are your constraints, but also this is what's possible with the software. And I can understand and totally empathize with a lot of engineers that feel not well represented in that capacity, because either the product manager doesn't want to upset the apple cart, they have their own agenda, or they just don't have the technical wherewithal context necessary to communicate the idea. That happens all the time, and it's tragic.
Indeed. So, as we're talking about this, it is mid-February of 2024. We are in month 14 of ridiculous layoffs and compression in the tech space. A lot of these layoffs seem reflexive. A lot of them seem like they're cutting into muscle and bone. What's your take on this current environment?
Well, I think we made huge speculative mistakes in hiring during pandemic times. I just think that we got our eyes got way bigger than our stomach, and growth at all costs became the focus, ironically, in a pretty tumultuous time for society. And so at first, what I kind of felt was, okay, this is a correction, right? This is just that over-speculation correcting itself. And I think what's unfortunate with our connectedness and everybody being able to see the news, it has perpetuated this like trend that, oh, I need to be cutting back too, right? Google's doing it, Meta's doing it. I need to be kind of trimming the fat as well. And so there's been this like massive, like you said, reflexive kind of, oh, I need to correct my team size to get better profitability as well. And so it sounds very inhuman. It sounds very insensitive, but you see a lot of these executives kind of following a trend, right? Of, we got to tighten the belt. Sorry, everybody, we got to get our pound of flesh for investors too, right? And so unfortunately, it's kind of been this snowball effect of the larger companies saying, oh man, like investors actually care about profitability and earnings per share, right? And so we have to kind of correct our team size to true that up, right? And then, okay, then it kind of goes downhill, and you have these mid-sized companies say, oh no, these share prices are going down, interest rates are going up, we got to tighten the belt too, we absolutely have to. And again, the snowball builds and the snowball builds, and here we are. And yeah, it's tremendously unfortunate, and I think it's one of the more turbulent times that I've seen in my own career.
Thanks for giving me this quick moment for our sponsor, Coverage Cat. We're very intentional about who we allow to sponsor the PeopleStack podcast. And when I connected with the folks at Coverage Cat, I quickly learned that they are an excellent fit as a sponsor. If you live in Washington, California, Texas, New York, or Florida, Coverage Cat is a free concierge service that will help you find the best price and coverage for your umbrella, car, home, and renter's insurance. And yes, loyal tech leader audience, we know that most of you need insurance, whether it's umbrella or other insurance to protect your wealth. We know how annoying dealing with insurance companies can be, so we love how Coverage Cat is making this process super easy. Fill out one form and they compare across dozens of carriers to find you the best coverage and price while you skip the spam and sales calls. Get your free optimized insurance quote today at coveragecat.com.
We've gone through bust cycles like this in the past. The late 90s going into the early 2000s, the 2008 time period, and a couple of other smaller bubbles since then. One of the things that I think marked those tumultuous times is now these were not low performers who were let go. These were not people who were unskilled who were let go. These were not people who were not ready, willing, and able to add value who were let go. So now you've got this massive glut of free radical talent out there. Who's going to hoover that up and turn it into the next massive company that does something cool?
Well, I think what's ironic and what I've been seeing is a lot of engineers are saying, you know what? I'm done with the big corporations. I'm done with other people kind of controlling my destiny. I'll try my hands at freelancing, or I have this itch that I want to scratch from a product standpoint, and I'll build that. So I think what we're starting to see is a lot of people embracing a little bit more of a gig kind of economy and wanting to kind of strike it on their own. But for those that are less risk averse, I think there's a lot of wait and see to see where investment money is going to go and where capital is being allocated. So I actually feel like, yes, there is a glut of engineering talent on the market, but what catalyzes the correction of that glut is investment and executives and folks with capital seeing significant growth opportunity in particular areas, right? So right now it's AI. If you're not AI, you're not getting a check, right? So, you know, if I had to point my finger at something today, it would be AI. But, you know, who can say where we'll be in 6 months? I just know that there's an amazing, amazing, bountiful group of talented engineers that don't have homes and are feeling a little wayward. And for such a boom time of abundance to have folks that have worked so hard to get where they are and suddenly realize there's not as strong of a market for what they're offering, that's scary. And I feel for a lot of those people out there on the market right now.
We do see that, especially at the top end where you've got your engineering managers and higher, there are homes for people. There's less competition at the top has always been a thing. My other favorite quote here is from Game of Thrones, and that is that chaos is a ladder. A lot of folks who were let go at the tail end of their software engineer life cycle. They can be out there looking for senior roles. Seniors could be looking for whatever of the bifurcation, trifurcation, quadrication they want to be doing. They can be looking for that next thing. For the folks that are lower on the totem, earlier in their career and earlier in their process, do you have any specific advice to give those folks for how to look for what's next or build what's next?
Yeah, certainly. But actually, I wanted to kind of go back to what you were saying about chaos being a ladder and there being more demand at top. I agree. But there's a wonderful post, and I recommend this frequently. The Pragmatic Engineer, I think, does a great job kind of bringing together data and kind of explaining and telling a story with data. And I've actually seen this anecdotally in our consulting practice, where there were sort of multiple levels of management, and you sort of had mid-management sitting between the CTO and engineering teams. I do think we're starting to see a consolidation there, right? Of having an engineering manager that can do a little bit of coding, right? And can kind of get their hands dirty with the team. Given these economic conditions, I think I am seeing more demand for that type of leader, right? And
Was
so I
this
do
the
think that.
article? Sorry, was this the article about directors getting hit the hardest and senior directors kind of going away as a tier?
The engineering management, that middle tier. So really interesting. And I agree. I think the folks that have been out of coding, right, and have been people managers for a couple of years now, those folks are being adversely impacted as well. And they were probably great engineering managers, great coaches, right? But now they have to like get their fingers on keys, and they haven't done that for 3 to 5 years. Imagine being put in that situation.
I don't have to. I'm in that situation. I haven't touched it. I have not coded. So I have not written production level code since 2010.
Wow, you've been
But,
out of it for a while.
well, I've been out of the my code is how I live and I build people instead focus. And I'm going to keep building the people because we're always going to need those, even if those people are entering AI prompts instead of actually writing code. But yeah, in the interim, in this tumultuous period, there's going to be that level of churn. When I look at the, I mean, it's very trendy to talk about the threat of AI, but when I look at what you need to understand in order to write an articulate AI prompt that gets you the thing that you actually want, you got to be an engineer.
100%, 100%.
You have to think
And
like an engineer.
that's even true for non-software related prompting. So like I did a prompt. I was actually taking a PRD for a client, right? And the PRD had like feature descriptions, but they weren't in a user story format. And I had to, oh yeah, I need to give it a window, right? Because of the token limitations. And I was thinking about like a cursor, right? You have to curse through this document. I'm like, how would an agile project manager or a product manager know enough to? So I was like, okay, start at this headline and then go down to this headline. Okay, great. Now go to the next headline and give me this window of data. And yeah, you need that computer science context and that understanding of how an LLM works to do that effectively. It's so true. Even I've been playing around with Flutter, just because did a little React Native. I've done a little bit of Kotlin. I really don't want to get into Swift for some reason. There's just a resistance to Swift.
Damn you, Apple.
I hear that there's no more interface builder. Maybe that's why I have such like a visceral reaction to it. But so I've played around with Flutter. And you have to know what questions to ask, and even more so when they get it wrong. Inevitably, when ChatGPT gets some syntax wrong, you need to be able to speak to, okay, why did this error occur? Like, and you need to give ChatGPT a little bit more context. So you absolutely need that initiation. And I don't think that that is going away anytime soon. I know that there are a lot of folks that are talking bullishly about AGI. But what we have right now is just a search engine you can have a conversation with. That's really what we're dealing with generative AI. So I think what matters is, okay, as an engineer, how can I use GitHub Copilot, ChatGPT, all these tools to be a better engineer? Stow the fear, focus on how you can harness the power of the tool.
To that aim, Copilot is hiring like a gangbuster.
Yeah, I know. I know.
So one of the things, and to hammer in on this point, this week OpenAI released Sora, their video creation, or they didn't really release it, they announced it. It's still in highly limited, highly contextual release. But the prompts that they're showing for the things that they've generated, you need to have a cinematographer's eye in order to understand why all of those specific words are in that specific prompt in order to get that specific outcome. So I think a lot of the existing LLM, the stochastic parrot that we've got going on here, you need to be able to prompt it into a mindset and a mind flow in order to get back out what you're expecting. And in order to do that, you need to understand the problem. In order to do that, you need to understand the life and the space that generated the text that it was trained on.
Right, 100%. And I think that that will be the case for a number of years, right? I don't think AGI is something that's going to be doing that decision making, that experience building for us anytime soon. You know, I don't know what that actually means. You know, every time I say it, I get it wrong. But you know, I think, you know, we don't have to worry about it next year. You know, we're going to see continued improvement and refinement of generative AI, but you still require expertise to steer the beast that is generative AI. And that's true for marketing professionals, cinematographers, engineers, managers, right? You have to know, have enough context to know what questions to ask, and then be able to respond meaningfully to what it gives you so that you can refine the data that it's providing you.
Tractors didn't put farmers out of business. It just helped them plow a field better.
That's it. That's it. And ChatGPT is, you know, the Stack Overflow you can have a conversation with.
It, you know, if they only trained it on Stack Overflow, actually, wait, no, that would be terrible. Don't do that. Don't, please, don't do that.
Well, so it's wild, right? So, and people forget, right? I was documenting something in Markdown, in VS Code, and I had Copilot enabled, and I was itemizing what a senior developer did and what a junior developer did, and so I had the title senior developer, and it pre-populated someone's name because it came from a code comment on GitHub somewhere, right? And I'm like, okay, yeah, remember, this is the data. It's just a sophisticated search engine, really. And I think it's very, very easy for us to get scared and intimidated and forget that it's not like monumental revolutionary technology. It's an incremental technology that's going to get us closer to something very, very meaningful.
So while we're talking about the future, let's continue talking about the future. When you imagine us having a follow-on conversation to this in, say, 5 years, if you had had immense success and everything went entirely the direction of Dan Pickett, what would you like to be able to say happened? What would be your dream for that next 5 years?
Honestly, I would say I helped over 6,000 engineers launch their career or make their career better. I think I'm at a stage in my career where I'm like you, I enjoy the cultivating and the shaping of engineering talent and you know, kind of starting to pave the way for the next generation. I don't want to be like DHH, like putting out a new framework. You know, I'm much more passionate about giving people the gift of loving what they do, right? I say that a lot. Probably annoys my team hearing that again, but like, I think I am so fortunate to be able to crack open an editor still and put on some tunes and just crank away, and somebody pays me for that. Like, I'm what, 22, 23 years into the game now, and I still can't believe like people are paying me to love what I do, and I want that for so many other people. It's not for everyone. I think it's really popular to say, oh, anyone can learn how to code, but if you love it, I want to help you make a career out of it. And that there's nothing more rewarding for me than doing that.
Beautiful, beautiful. When you think about the launchers that have gone through since the inaugural cohort, when do you think, so you said some of them are already becoming entrepreneurs. At what point do you think they're going to get to the place where their dreams have exhausted their potential or their dreams have outgrown their ability to articulate them?
It's a great question. I think we're already seeing that a little bit with engineers that make the transition to product or marketing, right? Of, okay, I've kind of taken this software engineering thing as far as I can. Let me get a little bit of an understanding of marketing or product. And I do think the vast majority of students that come through our doors have some kind of entrepreneurial motivation. Again, like you said, they often encountered a problem that they had to solve with technology, and they felt limited or constrained as a result of their lack of technical knowledge at that time. So I think that even going back to the core of their motivation and learning to code, there is entrepreneurial aspirations. And what I hope is that what they learned at Launch Academy and what they learned with our mentorship is entrepreneurship is a similar problem domain to computing, right? You run an experiment, you evaluate the results, you tweak a variable, and you run another experiment, right? And it goes back to that metacognitive thing. So I hope that through whatever professional angle they decide to go, they understand and don't get intimidated by a different problem domain, because they feel like they have the metacognitive skills to be able to overcome those challenges. I think a lot of engineers, myself included, I thought I needed to go and get an MBA. I needed to become like a professional engineer, whatever that means, right? And so, it took me a few years in the industry to realize that a CEO is a person just trying to add value in the world, and they're flawed, and they have shortcomings and anxieties, just like any other human, right? There's nothing superhuman about these people. They go through like some machine in an MBA program, and they come out a staunch professional. It's they're just people too. And so, I hope that everyone that we've been able to touch wouldn't feel that imposter syndrome that I felt diving into entrepreneurship.
Yeah, I feel like I have that is part of the education that I continue to give to all of the teams that I end up working with, is that they're the people that they're reporting to, and the CEOs and the CTOs and the head of product, the head of marketing, the head of sales, they're all people using the tools at their disposal to try and add value. And the only thing that's going to bind us together is if we understand each other's context. And the lesson for me came from that, when I was in my second, well, when I was in my first job out of college, it was a three-person startup, and the one of the people was the guy who said, "This is what I want to accomplish, and here's the money to do it." And the other guy was into regulatory stuff. And so it was clear we had no idea what we were doing. It was written on the sheet. It was on the label. We don't know what we're doing. We're going to figure it the F out. Here's how much runway we have to get it wrong. My second job, I ended up carpooling with the CTO because we lived within a few miles of each other, and we were commuting down into part of Delaware. And listening and talking with him, it's clear he's just a human guy. He's
Right.
10 years, 15 years my senior at the time, but just a dude trying to make it work. And so that colored everything going forward. Now, you talk to many engineers, and they're like, they're, especially if you get a drink or two in them, they will have no problem telling you that CEOs are flawed.
Right.
But not from the perspective of they made a wrong guess, or they looked at the data and came up with an inadequate or an insubstantial bet here. Their hypothesis was incorrect or proved false. It's going to be more of a character flaw than got it wrong this time.
Great point. It's so important to be constructive, right? With that criticism, right? And sure, there are your share of egotistical executives, right? But I think modern tech engineers, I have a saying, I love to be wrong, right? Like bring data that tells me I'm wrong, right? And to me, that means I'm doing something right because I have a team member that feels psychologically safe to come to me with a better solution, right? That makes me a better entrepreneur, executive, right? And I think a lot of, especially at the C-suite, have that mentality of, I want our best people challenging our assumptions. And if they can do that in a productive way, great. Like that means we have a great team.
It does. It does. When you think about great teams, and this would probably be leaning more on the Launchware side than the Launch Academy, how much of a great team doesn't come down to the technical aspects of it, in your opinion?
The tech is maybe 20%. It's about trust. It's about accountability. It's about the human things, right? So, one of the books that we require everybody to read as they come into the team is The Five Dysfunctions of a Team, right? And it starts with trust. And I found that if you have a team that trusts one another, and trust means two things, in my opinion, trust that they're going to do the job competently, right? So that you can rely on them, so that you're not like kind of peering over their shoulder and making sure they're doing what they need to be doing, right? But also trust that you can demonstrate vulnerability and it won't harm the way in which they perceive you, right? So there's the psychologically safe trust and then there's the competency trust. And I can't tell you how many teams we come into that don't have one of those two components. You have a director of engineering that fights with the product manager because they don't feel like the product manager is doing their job effectively, or
That's how you get microservices.
yeah, you said right, exactly. But it's like so common, and trust, I would say, we said 20% is technology, 80% is the people stuff. I would say trust is like 50 to 60% of it.
Beautiful. Wholeheartedly agree. So that wraps up my questions for you. Do you have some questions for me?
I think, what's your perspective on the desire of more senior engineers to cultivate talent in today's organization? Is today's organization permissive of that? And then is there a genuine interest in the majority of engineers at that phase of their career?
I believe that there is interest. I believe that there is demand. I believe that there is value. What I think is most lacking is the understanding of how. Because being a great engineer and being a great teacher, which is why I got hung up on the faculty thing, is it's not that they're diametrically opposed, it's just that they're two very different skill sets. Being able to mentor and coach human beings around managing their own self, managing their adulthood, and being able to show them that no, you use this syntax instead of this syntax in this case because it uses fewer resources. Those are two diametrically or They're, again, I don't want to say that they're diametric opposed. They're not opposed. They're just different. They're different skill sets entirely. That was one of the reasons why I made the split in 2010. I joined a company thinking, I am joining this company. They are working on these things. It is so cool. I am going to learn so much from them about JavaScript and about, like really deep things. And I got in there, and the people and team aspect of it was an absolute shit show. We couldn't get anything done because we couldn't agree on what was what. And at a certain point, so the person who was supposed to be my manager was being called to on the carpet every 20 minutes in leadership meetings because it was a high-level client. So we had no leadership at the team level. So I just did it. I had
Yeah, just
spent
jump in. Yeah, sure.
I had spent the last 6 years as a consultant going in on my own to go and reshape an organization to do this, that, and the other thing. And so 2010, joined this company to become an even better web developer. And that wasn't actually what they needed.
Right,
They
right.
hired
But
me as a web dever.
you filled the void, right? You filled the void and recognized that that was a need. And there was an opportunity for you because there was a professional interest in that direction, and you filled that void.
Yes, and because I could. There were other people there who recognized the need, and they may have even vocalized that there was a need,
Right,
but
right.
they either weren't being heard, or the people that were in a position to respond didn't know how. So, within the span of, so I went there as a 6 month contract to hire. My contract was extended to 9 months. When I joined in 9 months, instead of being a web dev, I was a web dev lead. And then 6 months after that, I was a tech manager. And then I was running groups of teams to do all of these things. And the reason that that was meteoric was because chaos is a ladder. This
Right.
organization was in chaos. And I could bring calm and structure to the chaos so that things got done. People loved their work again. We stopped losing employees every 4 weeks, and people were staying longer. And then they're like, great, you get to hire. And my leadership and I, so it was me, a senior tech manager, and a VP, that we were in broad agreement, lockstep. And we hired a slate of some 30, 35 or 40 engineers over the course of 2.5 months, 3 months. 2 years later, they were still with the organization except for two.
That's awesome. That's amazing. And we have similar sort of retainment numbers too, and we're really fortunate about that as well. But I mean, that's incredible for a team of that size to have only shed, two professionals. So.
It was necessary. And one of the guys came in, and he looked and sounded better in the interview and on paper than he was in reality. And he decided that, so pulling the curtain back just a little, we ran the platform that allowed e-commerce to happen for large brands that missed out on building interior talent in the 2000s. They were watching this whole internet thing saying, maybe it's a fad, maybe it's a fad, maybe it's a fad. Found out, oops, not a fad. Oh shit, we need an e-commerce platform. And they hired this company to do it. And I was running three or four major brands worth of stuff. And if one of the clients was down for a day, typical occurrence in the development shop, something happens and the website's just inaccessible for a few hours. We're talking millions of dollars in losses.
Sure. Yeah, huge
And
money.
so there was a lot of pressure and a lot of weight on top of all of this. And we got it to the point where it was easy. We got it to the point where it was easy. And we did that by listening to people, letting them speak, building the psychological safety that was required to have that conversation. But then also, while we were doing that, I was talking to them in one-on-ones, and I was talking to them at lunchtime about not work things so that they could shape themselves better as humans and better support themselves going through all of these challenges. Then they became web dev leads and tech managers and VPs. And my former boss is a CTO right now at one of the large brands. And it's that being able to mentor in that space, to coach in that space, is a different fundamental skill set from being able to code. Some of the
Yes.
people that I worked with were amazing coders, top level coders. If I had to do something, oh, actually, many of them work for projects that you know. Some of them are node maintainers. Some of them are, they're in high level tech places because that's their zone of genius.
Right.
Everything I have learned through all of the different companies and through the consulting and all that other fun stuff is that on a powerful running team, yes, everybody needs to have a level of competence at the thing that's on the label. You need somebody who is socially active that makes the team feel like a conducive whole.
The glue, yeah.
Yes, you need the glue, the social glue. So that's not like just like a functional glue. You need somebody who is the heart of the team that allows them to just be human with each other. You need skin and bones around that allows them to share knowledge long term and have structure around that. So as team members transition on and off the team, that it maintains a sense of self. And you need to deliver on what it is that you were asked for. And that takes different kinds of people with different kinds of focuses and different kinds of attributes. And making sure that those teams are selfless in how they work with each other and selfish for how they hold on to them, their sense of self. It, yeah, when it's working and everybody's firing on all cylinders, it's a thing of beauty.
Yeah, no, it's true. You touched on so many things. But I think what I heard most was in the beginning of there's a significant distinction between someone that can teach engineering and somebody that can do engineering. And we made the mistake very early on in Launch Academy's history. You know, we bring on apprentices that would effectively TA and help out the faculty. And they'd stay with us for 9 months and go off and do other things. And we would always, you know, the hubris of me, oh, of course they would want to come work at Launch Academy. We'll get the best engineers from the cohort. We'll get the sort of first picks, get the best technologists. And it was every time we did that, it was like an abysmal failure. It was really, really bad because they wanted to code. They just wanted to build, right? And here we were throwing them into a very human pursuit. So then we changed our criteria and we looked for the folks that, you know, were really the most helpful and the most kind of giving to the group. And we've been fortunate to have just amazing, experienced engineers come through our doors since we made that adjustment. But so
Beautiful.
true. See such a difference between those that can teach and those that can do.
Yeah, and there's going to be a mix of those things, and there are even more attributes than just those two. One of my favorite engineers, she was, if we're going to grade her out of 10 on her ability to code, she was 5, 6 on a good day. What she excelled at, though, was understanding how to distill what we were doing down into documentation and make it searchable.
Nice. Yeah, good.
So she became the class factotum. She was my chief librarian for making sure that we had a tremendous knowledge base that was easy to find, easy to navigate, and easy to understand.
And that's a great distinction too, as you're kind of talking, it occurred to me, I've coached team members. It's not necessarily just like the individual, it's how they fit in with the cast, right? So it's not necessarily just bringing the best and the brightest into a team. It's okay, what characteristics and things will make the cast better? And that's really hard to suss out in an interview process. But it's so true. Like everybody adds a little flavor to the soup. And you have to figure out how to make the best soup.
Yep, if the Avengers was just a bunch of Tony Starks, it would not have worked.
Totally, totally.
You have to have a blend. You have to have a different notes to make the chord
Right.
and
100%.
to make the chord successful. Wonderful. So that's all I have for you today. Where can people find you and Launch Academy out there in the wild world of the internets?
Yeah, so the best way to connect with me, I'm spending, for better or worse, a lot of time on LinkedIn these days. You can always, I think I'm the Pickett on LinkedIn. And you can learn about more about our courses, educational philosophy, and whatnot at launchacademy.com. And if you want to work with us on a professional services or training basis, you can reach out via launchware.com. And
Beautiful.
that's LaunchWare.
So not the kind of wear that you put on, the kind of wear that you install.
Exactly. There you go.
Great. It's been awesome talking with you, Dan. I'm sure we'll talk more very soon.
Thanks for the time. It was awesome. I had a blast.
Cool.
And that wraps up another episode of the People Stack podcast. Thanks for listening and for supporting our mission. We are all helping to positively transform the tech world, one tech leader at a time. I have so much gratitude for all of you, for our badass clients, our loyal listeners, every one of you who we've worked with. And I have to give a special shout out to my husband, Rob Allen. He's my co-CEO, the love of my life, PeopleStack Client Zero, and it is such a fun ride, finding new, ridiculously unreasonable levels of prosperity, joy, and fun with him every single day. And a quick thank you to Ketza for creating the catchy, inspiring theme music that we get to use in our podcast. We love each and every one of you. Big, big hugs. Aloha and mahalo.